You're listening to All Marine Radio on the All Warrior Radio Network. And a very good Thursday morning to you. It's a special day here in Marineland, and the 23rd day of February. I think if we had a feast day other than our birthday, it would be the 23rd of February. Today marks the 72nd anniversary of the flag raising on Mount Suribachi. And, again, while it was not a significant, it was momentarily significant in the battle, that flag going up, and then, you know, they fought for, you know, more than another month on that island. Its long history and what the image represents. Colors of Marine Corps today is a symbol today some things don't change, of the Marine Corps and the valorous conduct of Marines throughout American military history and throughout American history. So it is our symbol as much as the eagle, globe, and anchor is. And you can only see the silhouette, and you understand its significance. So today we remember the courage and selflessness and sacrifice on that island. And so today, and also today here on All Marine Radio, the landing began on November 19th. Operations before that to get ready for it, but next week we'll do some more stuff connected to the Iwo Jima campaign, because it's one that I think still to this day is fascinating, just the nature of the fighting on the island, and so we'll do more with that, and let me tell you what we're going to do today. One of the cool things, probably the coolest thing about this job, is crossing paths with, like yesterday, like, you know, with Colonel Barnum. You get to spend a couple hours talking to him and hearing him tell his story. So, last summer, a friend of mine, whose father was lieutenant on Iwo Jima, and his uncle was a PFC on Iwo Jima, Jess Humphrey, he said, "Hey, you know, if you'd like to interview my Uncle Cal, I can set that up." And I said, "Are you kidding me, man? I'd love to." So, I got a chance to interview Cal Humphrey. He's a PFC on Iwo Jima, and you're gonna hear that interview as we take a little bit of time here away from what we normally do on Thursday, which is talk transitions, in particular in this hour we talk Marines into management. On this day, the 23rd day of February, we'll talk Iwo Jima, as well we should. So you'll hear from Cal Humphrey here shortly. It's an incredible interview, because anytime you get a chance to walk that lane with guys who were there, and listen to the way they lived and the conditions under which they fought, very humbling, to say the least. And so Cal was gracious enough to spend an hour of his time with us, so you're going to hear that interview coming up here in a few minutes. And then after that, Michael Bassett is going to join us. He's a former Marine. He's now a recreational therapist. And so we're going to find he wrote me an email after we did one of the Boulder Crest segments, and he said, and he talked to me about how treatments for post-traumatic stress were changing, and so he told me a little bit about what he did, and I said, well, come on, let's talk about it. So Michael Bassett's going to come on and talk about the changing way that post-traumatic stress is being addressed, thankfully. And so I think one of the things that Ken Falk said was he would like to see kind of a triage system set up in which treatments, non-medicated treatments, would be the first alternative. Because the number one complaint you hear from guys who go to the VA is that they'll medicate me, but nobody really wants to deal with my problems in me. Now, they'll send me to group, but I don't think that's what I need. So it's interesting when you hear that. So we'll talk to Michael Bassett about that, and then the Gunner is going to come along. The Gunner and I will talk about Iwo Jima a little bit today, because throughout the course of your career in the Marine Corps, if you stay in and around it long enough, you know, you cross paths with guys who fought there. And you sit down and talk to them, and they tell you stories, and it's absolutely, it's, you know, I think it's riveting. And so Mike and I'll talk about that. We're also supposed to do a little gun talk today, which is always a favorite. So we'll talk to Iwo Jima, Cal Humphrey. You'll hear an interview we did with him and a PFC on Iwo Jima and a Midwestern guy and just a great interview. So with all of that said, the United States Marine Corps band, and we'll take a break from all the rest of this crazy world that we live in now. The United States Marine Corps band gets the day going on a day that we salute the Marines who fought on Iwo Jima, the 72nd anniversary of that flag going up, and a day that we remember an incredible battle in Marine Corps history. Motivation dedicated to guys who sang this song many years ago. Today. On Thursday, transition Thursday. Currently, 58 degrees under cloudy skies in Quantico. Camp Lejeune warming up, 69 and mostly cloudy. Granbury, Texas, mostly sunny and a high of 62. So temperatures getting warmer around the country. 28 degrees, though, in North Dakota. Cloudy skies. They got a little snow last night. In 29 Palms, 39 degrees and sunny. Camp Pendleton, 41 and sunny. At Camp Smith in Hawaii, cloudy, dark, and 71. In Okinawa, 60 degrees and cloudy and dark. In Fallujah, dark, clear, and 63, so it's warm enough. And in the Costa Mesa, Newport Beach, kind of cold this morning. Mostly cloudy, 47 degrees here. So that is a look at your weather here on All Marine Radio. We're going to take a quick break this hour of All Marine Radio, this special hour of All Marine Radio that we dedicate to the guys who fought on Iwo Jima, an iconic battle in the Marine Corps. And so today's a special day, the day that flag went up. And again, not a great, not a huge event in the whole scheme of the battle, other than Mount Suribachi was rendered for the most part safe, and the Marines turned their eyes to the north. And to get after the fighting in that direction, which would be long, difficult, and bloody. So we remember that today. But this hour of All Marine Radio brought to you by our friends at Battle Mug. The Battle Mug, you got to check it out. And it's snowing in 27 in Montana, in case you're wondering. I wasn't, but that little data point just showed up. Battle Mug starts out as 10.5 pounds of T6 billet aluminum. After being milled, machined, and anodized, it's ready for you. It's got a carrying handle that is the same handle that's on your M16 or your M4. It's got Picatinny rails on it so that you can mount scope, camera, laser. All of that works. It's serialized. It can be engraved. Mine looks awesome. It has a blue diamond on the base of mine, along with my name and rank. Very cool. And it's perfect for commemorative farewells, promotions, retirements, birthdays, Christmas, Valentine's Day, St. Patrick's Day, you name it. Check them. There's a whole line of products, so check them all out at battlemug.com. Enter the promo code Marine for 15% off. It's a veteran-owned and operated company made entirely in the United States. So with that said, Cal Humphrey going to join us next on a Thursday edition of All Marine Radio right here on the All Warrior Radio Network.
All I can say about MilitaryByOwner.com is, wow, I listed my house on your website for only 2 weeks in a tough rental market, and now my house is about to get rented. I will definitely recommend you guys to everyone in the military. Thank you.
Are you located near a military base? Advertise with Military by Owner for optimum exposure to the military community. Military by Owner has experience helping military families find, sell, or rent their home near a military base for the past 15 years. MilitaryByOwner.com, proven and dependable.
My name is Juan Perez Jr. I joined the military in 98. I commissioned as an officer, but I always had in mind the idea that I would go into the special operations community, particularly the special forces. I was accepted to go into selection, and I attended on September 8th of 2001. As I was making my departure out of the military, there was that uncertainty. What do I do next? How do I repurpose my skills in a way that's not only meaningful to me, but also that provides for my family and provides an increase in our a way of living, a quality of life. The Global South Foundation has resources when it comes to anything from building resumes to how to relate to a CEO in conversation, how to basically, again, repurpose that which I had learned in a career in special operations, dealing at the strategic and operational level. How do I take that and then turn it towards entrepreneurial spirit into business development, and how do I translate that so somebody can see that value? And in doing so, I landed a magnificent and very rewarding career I'm the VP of operations for an IT company called BuildSourced. What I say to veterans getting out, be bold. Be bold when you go to network. Go out to the GlobalSoft website, look at what events they have lined up, attend those events, you know, and participate. A lot of the events they hold, they're of key importance in this network. Go out there and engage, just like you would engage in a combat zone, you know, when you're networking there with folks that don't share necessarily your language, your culture, or your background, and yet we still make it happen. How can we not make it happen here?
The GlobalSoft Foundation is a great partner of All Marine Radio. Find out more about them at globalsoftfoundation.org/Marines.
I'm good, but I have a story, and I don't know where to start.
I'm good, but I feel alone in a crowd.
I'm good, but the past keeps coming back.
When the service member or veteran in your life says,
I'm good.
Are you really listening?
I'm good, but I can't get out of bed.
I'm good. But I can't sleep.
I'm good, but I feel overwhelmed.
I'm good, but I don't feel safe.
I'm good, but I still have nightmares.
I'm good, but I don't need any help.
I'm good, but I don't feel anything anymore.
I'm good, but I can't live like this anymore.
I'm really not so good. But are you ready to listen?
Suicide prevention is everyone's responsibility. Listen to the veteran or service member in your life. If you are in crisis or know someone who is, call the Veterans Crisis Line and Military Crisis Line at 1-800-273-8255 and press 1 for free 24/7 confidential support.
More than 2 million Americans have served in Iraq and Afghanistan, and the Department of Veterans Affairs reports that approximately 11 to 20% of those warriors may have experienced symptoms of post-traumatic stress disorder. As we recognize PTSD Awareness Month, Real Warriors Campaign volunteer Meg Mitchum, a former Army combat medic who served in Iraq, encourages fellow warriors to reach out when they need help.
The hardest step was admitting that I needed help coping with PTSD. Once I did, my command and unit fully supported me, and I was able to get the care I needed. Getting support helped me succeed in the military and now in my civilian career.
If you or a loved one is coping with an invisible wound, resources are available and they work. For more information, visit the Real Warriors campaign at realwarriors.net or call 866-966-1020.
As we recognize the service of America's men and women in uniform, let's also honor the families who sacrifice so much every day. Military families endure frequent deployments and separations. They carry on while their loved ones are sent into harm's way and wait patiently for their safe return. If you really want to honor a veteran, look for ways to support their families and thank them for their sacrifices. Go to legion.org/honorveterans to find out how you can help.
This is Montel Williams. As a U.S. Navy and Marine Corps veteran, I know the sacrifice that our servicemen and women make for us every single day. If you're a veteran or a military member transitioning out of the service, help is available to you. The U.S. Department of Labor can help you get training, find a good job, or further your education. Contact the Veterans Employment and Training Service at 866-487-2365 or visit dol.gov/vets.
You're listening to All Marine Radio on the All Warrior Radio Network. All right, you're going to hear an interview I did earlier this year. And Cal Humphrey, the uncle of a friend of mine by the name of Jess Humphrey and the Humphrey family. Jess's father, Robert Humphrey, a huge figure he's a big guy in American history. Let me say that. Huge influence, as a writer and a teacher. He was a lieutenant on Iwo Jima and, obviously survived the battle and then went on to do a lot of different things. He wrote a book called Leadership for a New Millennium. I would recommend to you. So, and it's based on a lot of Midwestern common sense, respect, but being tough values. And so his brother, Cal Humphrey, is still living, 91 years old, and joined us. So, without further ado, Calvin Humphrey, PFC, United States Marine Corps, on Iwo Jima, right here on All Marine Radio. You're listening to All Marine Radio on the All Warrior Radio Network. Seven 34 here on a Thursday morning. 9:34 in the Midwest, where my guest is from. He is none other than Cal Humphrey. Cal, first of all, thanks for taking time out of your day and joining us here on All Marine Radio.
Well, you're welcome. Glad to be here.
Well, that's awesome. What do you, first of all, we need to learn about you, okay, so we can know if we can take you seriously. You're born and raised where?
Well, I'll tell you what, I got my discharge out so I could remember myself what the hell happened to me. I was born in Emporia, Kansas, in 1925, and then we moved to St. Joe, Missouri. The folks moved to St. Joe, Missouri. I was just a child, and that's where I grew up pretty well. We really moved to Mound City. We did a little town north of St. Joe, but we grew up in that area.
And how many brothers and sisters?
I had two sisters and two brothers.
So five families and a kid, that's a respectable number, right?
Well, back in the 30s, that was kind of a small family.
You know what I was going to say? In the 50s, in the 60s, we had four. And I looked at my mom and dad like, well, what's wrong? Why? The Seymours have eight.
Yeah.
The Demers, they have 11. Like, what the hell? Four? Are you kidding me? Are you guys?
Yeah. That's kind of like we were, you know, we were the smallest probably in the area. There was 8, 9, 10, even up to 15. And the hell of it was most of us lived in two-room houses with no light, no electricity, no water. No running water, you know.
How did that work?
Well, it worked fine. We didn't know any difference. I think I was 15 before I got into a house that had electricity and running water. That's when we moved down to St. Joe from Mound City.
Where'd you sleep? If there, you got five.
Well, hell, you generally had two bedrooms and a kitchen, maybe a little bitty old living room.
Right.
And you always filled the bedrooms with beds, and the girls slept with mom and dad, and the boys all slept in one bed, you know.
Fighting.
Back then, it's pretty cold. You're happy to have a couple guys with you.
How does the Marine Corps get on your radar from Missouri?
Well, you know, we were back in World War II. You know, nobody thought about not going.
Right.
Everybody, I mean, it was just a fact you were going to go to service.
All right, hold on. Let me stop you. First of all, where were you on December 7th? What were you doing?
I was in school in Lee Summit, Missouri. I was down there. I wasn't living at home. I was working for a farmer down in Lee Summit, Missouri.
How old were you?
I was 17.
17. You're working, going to school, and on that Sunday morning, did you go to church? Were you a church going kid, or what were you doing?
Well, I was a church going kid till I got big enough to sneak off and go fishing.
So you were fishing that morning?
No, I was probably milking cows.
All right, and so when you heard about it, as you just said. Nobody thought about not going. Everybody was going to go do their part. Did you know anything about the Marine Corps at that time in your life?
I didn't know anything about the Marine Corps, and we didn't pay much attention to the war. You know, we were just living. It really wasn't like these wars now where you get, you know, you all got radios and everybody had a damn thing, and you hear everything that's going on, you know.
Right.
We didn't hear hardly anything. Unless something really bad happened, there'd be a little article in the paper about it or something like that, you know. But we didn't sit around and watch television, and because most people didn't have them. You didn't have television back then.
Wow.
I got my first television. I went to come back from the service and went to farming. And I bought the first television in that farming area. It was a little bitty old thing, you know. I'd sit there and look at that just amazed how they could put that picture on that thing. But, see, back then we didn't get the news like you get it now. You know, when some 15 minutes after somebody gets shot overseas, we hear about it.
Right.
We just didn't. We didn't have that news. We didn't have that news cycle that we got now.
Yeah. That's not a good thing either, I don't think. The my guest this morning from the great state of Nebraska is Cal Humphrey. And Cal's nephew, Jess, is a colleague of mine. I'd like to call him a friend, but I'm very careful who I call friends there. Cal, but he was a member of the Alpha Company, 1st Battalion, 27th Marines, on the volcanic island of Iwo Jima. He's gracious enough to join us this morning, and we're talking about where he was prior to the war. So December 7th rolls around, and then how the hell did he get in the Marine Corps?
Well, I'll tell you what, they just put me in the Marine Corps.
Oh, really?
Yeah. And I wasn't, it says here I was 66 and a quarter inches tall, so that was a 5'7". And I probably weighed about 130. So I think the Marines were needing people.
they were needing people. Holy smokes. So 130 pounds at 5'6". Holy smokes. So they tell you you're going to be a Marine. And what'd you say? Okay.
Hell, I didn't know anything about it. Yeah. Okay.
And so then where did they send you?
Well, they sent me to boot camp in San Diego, and I think that was about a month. And then we went to that line camp up there, Pendleton.
Right.
And we were there for a few months, and then we went to Hawaii, and we spent most of our time in Hawaii up there on the King Ranch up there in the desert, training.
Right. And now this
and
is.
We had a lot of training.
And this is, hey, Cal, this is 1942?
It was three, wasn't it? Four, three or four.
40, okay. All right.
Yeah.
And so you're in Hawaii, and now you're training with the 5th Division?
Yeah, the 5th Division, 27th Marines.
All right. And that gets made, for people that are familiar with it, what a lot of Carlson's Raiders, a lot of Paramarines made up that. That was a pretty that was a pretty experienced group that you walk into.
Absolutely. I think that's why they put them in there, because all of them came in. I think they made them all sergeants and corporals and things like that, because all of our squad leaders were from that group, you know, that was with Carlson's Raiders.
What were they like? What were they like to train with? So you report, you're fresh off the street. You go to boot camp, and now these guys have been fighting for a while. What were they like to work with?
They were great guys. They were great guys. They had been, you know, they'd been through the ranks. They knew everything. They weren't up there, you know, like when you went to boot camp. You know, those guys were jerks, but these guys were really good guys. They knew everything. They weren't trying to show off. They taught me an awful lot. And I had several friends of them that were really good friends of mine. In fact, I had, you know, my platoon sergeant was really a good friend of mine.
What's his name?
What's his name?
Yep.
Yes, you shouldn't ask me.
You told me that Les Jenks.
Yeah, a real good friend. In fact, he stopped. He was coming. His folks were owned a mortuary in New York, and he retired. When he came, him and his wife were going to California. They stopped there and spent a couple of days with me in Omaha.
How long ago was that?
Oh, God, that's been a long time ago. Probably 12 years, 13 years. 14 years. I don't know. I've been here 29 years, so it's been a long time.
All right.
So when you get my age, you know, I'll be 91 next month. When you get my age, names and dates, and times, kind of go by the wayside.
That's a long time to like have to remember. That's like a lot of stuff.
Yeah.
That's like it's when you're young, you don't have to remember that much stuff, but as you get older, there's a lot of stuff that you got to remember.
Well, I can still remember stuff I did when I was 4 or 5 years old, but a lot of times I have a little hard time remembering what I did yesterday.
Yeah, trust me, I'm with you. I'm with you. And I think Jess told me that John Bazelon was in your battalion.
John Bazelon was in the 28th,
I'm sorry.
Yeah.
I knew
John. Yeah, he was in the 28th.
How did you know him?
Oh, I see him up Slop Chute, you know. We you know, back then, you know, they had those slop chutes on the, where you could just go up and you get beer for 15 cents or something. A lot of people went up there every night. John was there quite a bit, and I talked to him quite often.
Tell us about him.
He got nutty. You know, he got that award. Right. And when we went into Evo, I think he thought he was going to do the same thing. Well, hell, he got shot right off the bat.
Right. The what kind of guy was he? I mean, I
thought he was a pretty nice guy. You know, well, of course, we was all about that snockered when we were together, but right. I thought he was a fine guy.
Really? The So you do your training, and then what's the most memorable thing in terms of either what you learned or in training from the group of guys that comprised, you know, your NCOs and the leadership of the 27th Marines? What's the number one thing they taught you?
Well, they just taught you a world of stuff, you know, that how to take care of yourself and try not to be a hero, but do your job. And they were pretty good. But the hell of it was, they didn't last very long. Most of them were killed in the 34th day on Evo. In fact, our lieutenant was killed. The first one we had wouldn't get. We were all about six of us in a big shell hole there, and he wouldn't get out of it when we left. When we had to leave, had to going across that field.
So he was a smart guy.
Yeah. And then the next one we got lasted about a day and a half. I didn't even hardly get to see him. And then we didn't get any more. We didn't have any more lieutenants all the way through when I was there.
All right. I have an email for you. And if you have a question or comment, you can send a text message to 714-661-8107. You can send an email to live.allmarineradio@gmail.com, or you can call if you want to ask Cal a question yourself. 714-884-4294. The question says this: Mac, where did 27th Marines land on the morning of D-Day? So,
well, we had the beaches were, colored like red, white, and we landed on red.
All right. Red was so the closest to Suribachi was Green Beach. That's what's 28th Marines, right?
That's where they landed. We all the first wave, which I was on, landed in Amtrak's. And, you know, they ran us up on the beach as far as they could go.
Right.
And then we bailed out of the damn things, and that beach was, you know, that's all volcanic ash. I don't know if you've ever seen it, but
yeah, absolutely.
It's soft and tough to walk in and run in, and we got in pretty good. We got up next to the bank, and then the Higgins boats started coming in. Of course, then the all hell broke loose. You know, that was a devastating thing there. That for the first 2 or 3 hours.
Let's talk about that, Kel. So you guys were in track vehicles, and you're off the coast, and the Navy's plastering that. And the Navy and Marine Corps Air are hitting the island. What were your thoughts as you were headed to the shore?
Well, I was manning a 50-caliber machine gun on that Amtrak, and so I was standing up where I could see everything. And there wasn't any airplanes. It was all naval.
Naval guns.
Yeah, and you couldn't even see the island. And, you know, it takes you a long time to get in. Those tracks don't go very fast. You know, you get out there, you all load up, and then you run around in a circle, everybody gets lined up. And the time you lined up, the division's going to hit the beach, you know. Of course, you got people lined up for a mile.
Right.
And then, so we get in, and they take us up on the beach as far as they can, and then the Higgins boats start coming in. And, of course, they quit shelling it.
Right.
But then the aircraft came in and started bombing it.
Okay.
The Navy aircraft, small ones.
Right.
And then all hell broke loose, you know, from the Japanese. And of course they had that island all gridded off, and so they were very effective. They just killed the hell out of guys. You couldn't even hardly see the back. When you look back, you couldn't see anything part of the dead guys. And they had a lot of boats out in the water. And
right.
It was a really, I don't know, I think we probably lost an awful lot of people. I don't know any numbers or anything like that, but just from looking, it was terrible.
Right.
So our mission was to go straight across the island, across the airfield to the other side, and right. The 28th was to go and turn and go and take Sarabachi.
Okay.
They took that in about 3 days, I think, because I remember seeing a little flag put up there about the second or third day, I can't remember what, this little bitty old thing. And then they had the big ceremony, you know, where they got a big flag up there and took the picture.
Matt, can you believe that after 70 years they finally identified the right people in the picture here in the last
year? Well, I can believe that. You know, it was a confusing situation over there, no matter what you did, you know.
Right.
So I can believe they were all up there, and he was trying to gather up a bunch of guys to put that flag up. You know, he needed about two. What did he get, six of them?
Six.
And to make a picture, and it turned out to be great for him.
Yeah, hell of a picture.
It sure was.
But
I can believe they could have made a mistake, because there was probably 6-8-10 guys standing around watching, you know.
Yeah, and they were up there for a while. Do you remember? Did you see the first flag go up? Do you remember that at all?
Yeah, no, I didn't see it go up. It wasn't very high. It was only about 3 or 4 feet high, and it looked like somebody carried it up in their pack or something. You know,
right.
Just a little one. I told the guy. Remember, we were starting to go the other way, but we were still getting some fire off Sarabachi, you know, some rifle fire. And I remember we turned around and looked at that flag, and I said, well, we won't have to watch our asses anymore. It looks like they've taken that hill.
Just to answer the emailer, if you look at where 1st Battalion 27th Marines is on Red Beach, it goes from the south, adjacent to Sarabachi. 28th Marines is on Green Beach. Then there's Red 1, which is 2nd Battalion and 27th Marines. Red 2 is further north, and that's where the 1st Battalion 27th Marines lands. And it's probably right at the base of Airfield Number 1. So there's a gap between Airfield Number 1 and Sarabachi. That's kind of 2nd Battalion 27th Marines and then 28th Marines. 1st Battalion 27th Marines, it looks like you guys headed right across the southern end of the airfield to the far side.
And we were supposed to go clear across that airfield, the far side. And the far side, you didn't go to the water. There was a great big, looks like 20-acre depression there that was kind of sea level. You know, you go down another bank So that's as far as we went. We didn't go down in that depression there. And then we turned and went up the island.
So this is your first time in combat, Cal. So,
yeah. Mm-hmm.
So do you remember as you got on the island, what the hell is going through your mind as you see, you know, you're involved, you don't know it yet, but you're involved in one of the greatest battles of World War II and certainly in Marine Corps history. What were your thoughts as you were,
well, you
as
know,
you were coming off the beach?
You're so dumb, I guess. I really wasn't all that frightened till we got on up there and then when you get into these battles and you get mortared, you know. Of course, we lay in those goddamn foxholes and get to shaking our teeth and our teeth would bump and your flesh would even twitch. You know, you'd be so goddamn scared. You'd be terrified.
Right.
But when you got out, you kind of laugh at each other and go on. But it's a terrifying thing. And some guys get scared. They just lay there like babies. They couldn't, they had their rifles so tight you couldn't hardly get them out of their hands, and their teeth would be, you know, just like they're going to pop their mouth and be so tight. But it was a terrifying thing. But the first day didn't seem to bother me too much, because I was too dumb to know what the hell was going on, I guess. But even with the guys dying. You know, we all kept toilet paper in our helmets. You know, when we go on these,
right.
We did that back in the States. When we go out, I remember looking up there when I was on the beach and I see that toilet paper flipping down. I thought, oh my God, somebody got his head blew off. But it's enough to make people go nutty in a fruitcake, you know. That first day didn't seem to. I just didn't know what the hell was going on. I suppose you're just kind of numb.
When you think about that first day, do you have a lasting memory? One thing you remember? Anything more than other things on the first day?
Well, I remember we had a foxhole right up in front of us, right on top of the hill there. It was a cement dome thing,
mm-hmm.
And we had Jinx said we got to take that damn thing out. We can't get out. We can't get over. But it did have some cracks in it where I guess the bombs done something to it. And he sent a couple of the older guys crawled up there and got a flamethrower in it. So we got by that obstacle in pretty good shape, and we got back up on the airport, and it was just littered with bombs, big holes. It was hell. Some of them was 6-7 foot deep, you know, and 15-20 foot across. I don't know what kind of bombs made those. But
big bombs.
They were good for us. Because we could kind of hopscotch from those from one to the next and get across there. We didn't have to dig any foxholes going across that airport. We just kind of moved out, crawled around, and got over.
And you guys got to the far side? Did you get to the far side on day one?
We got there in about day two, I think it was.
Okay.
Pretty well. Day one, we didn't do too much. We had a lot of snipers. There was some snipers out on that airfield in some of those holes, and there was, I know there was a plane, looked like an old plane that had been scrapped or something. There was a sniper in. They did get a half track up there and blast it out of there. That's when we got out. Our hole moved on out. And I remember they told us out in the ocean, they said, well, they didn't think the Japs had any guns on there do anything bad to their tanks, you know. Well, hell, the first tank that went up above us just got blown to hell. I said, well, that settles that question.
I guess that answers that.
Yeah.
Maybe they do have an anti-tank gun up there.
I think they convinced those tank guys to that too, because that first one went up.
My guess this morning is Cal Humphreys. He a member of 1st Battalion, 27th Marines, Alpha Company, as it were, and landed on Iwo Jima in 1945. And we're talking about the landing. I've got another email question. Mac, how did, as a young guy, his first battle, he said he wasn't that scared that day, but I'm sure that he's given the death he saw on the beach. It had to make an incredible impression on him. Did he just put it out of his mind and keep going because that's what he had to do? You saw stuff you'd probably never seen in your life that day. How did you deal with it in your head?
I think everybody dealt with it the same way. I think it was just awesome. You were just there. I don't think probably your mind wasn't there altogether, but you had a few things to do that kept you busy. We had to keep moving out, try to move out. Of course, and you could hear those goddamn bullets whizzing by you, and then they were still shelling the beach and shooting mortars at the beach. The thing that really saved a lot of us was those mortars went down in that pretty deep in that ash before they went off, which probably saved a hell of a lot of guys.
So if it would have been normal dirt and they would have been surface bursting mortars,
the explosion would have been terrible.
Right.
We might not have gone on there.
Wow.
But I can't explain it. I guess your mind kind of does something to you. I mean, what can you do? You can't panic and run back out in the ocean, and you goddamn sure don't want to run ahead. So you just kind of stay there with everybody else and there wasn't anybody to shoot at.
Yeah, how did that piss you off? You're all this stuff's going on, and there's nobody to shoot at. What the hell?
Well, that's what I say. You just don't know what the hell to do. You couldn't dig a foxhole in that crap.
So you kept so you kept following Jenks.
Well, you just
I hope
was like us. He didn't go very far either.
I hope Jenks knows what he's doing because I'm behind him. Now, you and I were talking the other day, and I said, "What was the secret to you were wounded on what, D plus 19?
I think so, something like that.
Okay, and I asked you what was the secret to that, and you said never be the first one out of the fighting position.
You need to look around a little. But we were all pretty careful, but still a hell of a lot of us got killed.
Wow. All right. There
wasn't any safe place. There wasn't any safe place. When you got up there and you had to go back and replace people, you know, you can't do that hardly on the front line. So it was worse back there than it was on the front line, because you had a company back there digging in, and hell, that island was, you could see pretty well everywhere. Those guys were a little on the high ground compared to when from the airports, you know.
Right.
Christ, you'd just get the poop mortared out of you. It didn't last very long, 15, 20 minutes, and then our guys would find out where they were and start throwing mortars back, you know, and get it stopped. But 10, 15 minutes, mortars flying all around you is scary.
That'll piss you off. You know how long? Now we have a radar beam that we shoot across the ground, and when they shoot something at us, it breaks the radar where it goes up, and it breaks it where it comes down, and then we get the exact grid that they shot it from. So
that has helped us to beat hell, because it generally probably took our guys 10, 15 minutes to
see it, right?
Locate them.
Yeah, they had to see it.
Uh-huh.
Which means they got to see enough shots to find that thing. What the hell is it? Oh, it's over there. Well, now, you can imagine that. Let me tell you how it works now, Cal. We'll have one of those drones flying overhead, and we have this, it's called counter-battery radar, you know, laid out across an area, let's say Fallujah or Ramadi in Iraq, and then they shoot. And as soon as that thing comes back down and breaks the plane the second time, you get the point of impact, you get the point of origin, and then you very quickly take the point of origin and you send it by computer to the guy running the drone. He takes the camera, and the drone goes right to that grid, and here they are standing there.
Yeah, that's great.
Yeah, and I'll tell you, in less than 60 seconds.
Mm-hmm.
And then guess what happens at about 4 minutes into it?
Yeah,
exactly. Exactly.
The only thing I thought they did wrong is bomb. They used bombs. I always told Les, I said, if we can get these guys to drop napalm, we'll be in good shape. But these damn bombs they can't get anybody in any caves. They can't really hit those pillboxes. I said, unless they're lucky.
So napalm. Explain why napalm was effective.
Oh hell! You know, they'd drop that stuff and it'd, you know, it spread for long ways, and it cook them. It even gets hot, you know, and go in the mouths of those caves and stuff like that. But if they'd have dropped napalm on that island, they'd have probably hurt somebody. But all that other crap, I don't think it hurt anybody worth a damn. Breached a few pillboxes, but I don't think killed very many people.
All right. Now, Cal, I've got to take about a 2-minute break. Can you hold on, and we'll continue our discussion?
You betcha.
All right. From Omaha, Nebraska. Is it Calvin?
Calvin.
Calvin. That's kind of a Baptist name, isn't it?
Yep, probably.
Calvin Humphrey. He's the uncle of a good friend of mine, Jess Humphrey, and he's gracious enough to join us here on a Thursday edition of All Marine Radio, right here on the All War Radio Network. We're going to take about a 2-minute break. We'll come back. We'll continue our discussion about what it was like to fight on Iwo Jima. More of that coming up next.
MilitaryByOwner.com is an excellent resource for any military family moving to a new area. We found a ton of homes to choose from and purchased a house 8 days later. This was the only site I used. Thanks, military by owner.
Are you PCSing? Do you need to find a home near a military base quickly? With over 45,000 listings and 15 years of experience helping military families find, sell, or rent their home near a military base, militarybyowner.com can help. Military by owner, proven and dependable.
My name is Juan Perez, Jr. I joined the military in 98. I commissioned as an officer. But I always had in mind the idea that I would go into the special operations community, particularly special forces. I was accepted to go into selection, and I attended on September 8th of 2001. As I was making my departure of the military, there was that uncertainty. What do I do next? How do I repurpose my skills in a way that's not only meaningful to me, but also that provides for my family and provides an increase in our a way of living, a quality of life. The Global South Foundation has resources when it comes to anything from building resumes to how to relate to a CEO in conversation, how to basically, again, repurpose that which I had learned in a career in special operations, dealing at the strategic and operational level. How do I take that and then turn it towards entrepreneurial spirit into business development? And how do I translate that so somebody can see that value? And in doing so, I landed a magnificent and very rewarding career. I'm the VP of operations for an IT company called BuildSourced. What I say to veterans getting out, be bold. Be bold when you go to network. Go out to the Global South website, look at what events they have lined up, attend those events, you know, and participate. A lot of the events they hold, they're of key importance in this network. Go out there and engage, just like you would engage in a combat zone, you know, when you're networking there. With folks that don't share necessarily your language, your culture, or your background, and yet we still make it happen. How can we not make it happen here?
The Global Soft Foundation is a great partner of All Marine Radio. Find out more about them at globalsoftfoundation.org/Marines.
This is U.S. Navy and Marine Corps veteran Montel Williams. During my 22 years of military service, I had the honor of working beside many brave servicewomen. They are the fastest growing population of veterans, and they can be a great asset to your company. Women veterans are trained to take initiative, adapt to change, and they're quick to learn. If you're an employer or a woman veteran, call the U.S. Department of Labor at 866-487-2365 or visit careeronestop.org.
You're listening to All Marine Radio on the All Warrior Radio Network. You're listening to All Marine Radio on the All Warrior Radio Network. Five minutes after 8 o'clock here on a Thursday morning. And privileged this morning to be joined by a veteran of the Battle of Iwo Jima. His name is Cal Humphrey. And member of the 27th Marine Regiment, Alpha Company, which makes him part of the 1st Battalion. And we continue our discussion and kind of talked about the first day, Cal. I got a couple emails, so let me ask them. Mac, early in the battle, what killed the most Marines? Was it indirect fire, mortars? Was it machine guns? Cal?
I think it probably was mortars and shells.
Okay.
There was a lot of bullets flying around, but I don't. You hear them whistling by, you know, like kind of make a sound when they go by you. But I couldn't answer that question. I don't know.
Okay. All right. Next question.
And some parts of the beach was a lot different than others, you know.
Right. Right. No, I mean it's very interesting as you read different accounts of the battle how different it is depending on where you were.
Sure.
Next question is. Mac, how did those guys sleep? It seems like when you read about the battle, they operated almost what would seem to be 24 hours a day because of the Japanese threat being all around them. How the hell did they sleep?
You had two men to a foxhole, two men. One was supposed to be awake all the time. We had to be conscious of that Banzai crap, you know, they pull everywhere.
Right.
Every night. So we had the Navy shot flares. That island was never dark. It was, you know how a flare is, it kind of, you can just see. And so we'd set our grenades up. We'd set our machine guns up. We'd set our 37-millimeter guns in our line with the canister ammunition, spread out our BAR men, because we didn't know when this bandit was going to come, early in the morning or night or what the hell ever.
Right.
And that's one guy was supposed to sleep and the other guy was supposed to stay awake, which hell never happened. You know, we both went to sleep. But hopefully there's enough guys somewhere around in the line that wake up and start shooting, wake you all up. And we killed, at the end of the thing, we killed a lot of Japs at night, one at a time. I don't know whether they were looking for ammunition or water or, walking around out there. And my guys, when I took over the squad, we killed one the last night before I got hit. I told the guys, I had two recruits with me because they were just got them that day. And I said, I want you guys to aim, and I want you to don't shoot till I tell you, because I want this son of a buck to get up close enough we can kill him. I don't want to wound him out there throwing grenades at us. So we got him done. But a lot of these guys listening to this might think that old guy's nutter in a fruitcake. You know, you keep hearing all the time these people don't want to talk about Do you ever hear that? You know, you don't want to talk about it.
Yeah, he came home and never said a word.
Well, that's what I told one of my boys, he said, well, Dad, you never talk about it. Let me tell you something. What am I going to say to you? I come home and see your mom and say, Mom, I just spent a month without taking a bath or changing my clothes and ate K-rations every day. And I did brush my teeth once in a while. I thought I was going to have enough water, but I had to use the same toothbrush I cleaned my rifle with.
Who
the hell wants to hear that crap?
How'd that taste?
it wasn't too bad. And then you run out of toilet paper, you got to wipe your butt with your hand and clean it off. I said, one thing we did have, we had that volcanic ash clean your hands up pretty good.
Does it? Well, they use it in a lot of soaps now, right?
I said, you can't talk about that kind of stuff, and you damn sure can't talk about people getting blown up and getting their arms blown off and spitting in a foxhole with some poor bastard bleeding to death. You can't do anything for him but give him a morphine shot. And you can't, I said, this isn't the movies. You can't call a corpsman because, first place, they probably couldn't hear you, and you wouldn't want to have somebody have to get up and get killed getting to you. And if he was smart, he wouldn't get up. So I said, it's just horrible. I hear these, wanting to put these girls into combat. It's probably like you say, it's probably nothing like we went through. So maybe these girls can handle the front lines, but they can't handle the front lines like those boys had to in World War One. No matter where you are, whether you're in the Pacific, where you're they couldn't do it.
I don't think they can do it, to be honest with you, Cal. I mean, you might be able to do it back here, but you know that.
Yeah, they couldn't do it, and you wouldn't want them to do it. For Christ's sake, who wants to take our national treasures and put them on the front line?
Yeah, no, Marines will handle it. You know, it's just like if you had a weak guy, what do you do with him? He's going to go work in the office. He'll be the company driver. He'll do this. He'll do that. They'll find something for him because there's not that many women that'll do it. And quite frankly, we're having an interesting discussion about that the other day. It's like, so a squad leader, somebody gets confused. What's a squad leader do? He grabs them and throws them.
Yep.
Right? And he didn't have time to talk. Hey, go. And
no.
Yeah.
They just can't. I'll tell you what I carried. I had that M1, was loaded that weighs about 9 pounds.
M1 Garand, right?
I had a 20 pound of explosive, and I always carried competition C2. I had 3 concussion grenades, and then I carried a phosphorus grenade because I like to throw those. And then you got probably 4 or 5 clips or 6 or 7, however scared you were,
Right.
And you had, had your other little crap you're supposed to have with you, You had your canteen, your bayonet, and your K-bar and all that crap. A woman can't do that.
Yeah, well, let me tell you.
They're just tougher than hell. They got, I shouldn't say that. A lot of them could.
Well,
some of the guys couldn't.
No, that's what I'm saying.
I couldn't carry a flamethrower. It weighed about 60 pounds. Hell, I tried it. I couldn't even get 10 steps.
With the flamethrower?
And even if I could, I'd have said I couldn't. Those things get you killed.
Listen to this. This is written by a Marine Corps Sergeant Major who was involved in the testing that the Marine Corps did with female Marines, and who all, you know, by every account, you know, did their best and are good Marines. It's just not an easy task. He says this: the best women in the Ground Combat Integration Task Force as a group in regard to infantry operations were equal to or below, in most cases, the lowest 5% of men in the group in the test study. So that was the best woman is equal to or below the lowest 5% of guys. Okay, now, so what does that tell you? That tells you that it's hard work, and, you know, the weaker guys struggle to do it, and, you know, I'd say, and that's what the test says, that the lowest 5%.
And he is right, because we had some of them, and we had some that couldn't do anything. One of the guys, there was two guys in my platoon, Les Yanks, the sergeant, and a kid, don't say his name, but a kid from Chicago, that I don't think he walked a step on Iwo Jima. He was damn near crawled everywhere. And he wasn't worth a damn. I don't think he probably even fired his rifle.
Wow.
And I'll tell you something else probably nobody would realize, maybe like in other areas it was different. I saw very, very few Japs. Very few.
So how did you,
It was all digging them out, blowing them out, covering them up, sealing up the caves. And you'd see I told Les one day, I said, you know, Les, we've lost over half of our platoon, and we haven't visibly seen kill over 7 or 8 or 9 Japs. You know, when we'd blow up a pillbox, we'd get them all, or some little structure they had built. But the right. ones in the cave, you might see one or two in the door, and then you'd throw a phosphorus grenade in there and then seal the damn thing up. But I said, we're not, if these guys are moving backwards, when we get to the end of this island, it's just going to be all people.
Right. Right. Well, let me ask about that. I have an email that says, Mac, I'm looking at a map of the battle, and 1st Battalion, 27th Marines, goes across the island, and then they turn towards the northern end of the island.
Right.
And they run in to the eastern side of Hill 362 Alpha, which was built like a fortress.
Right.
Tell us about the thing. I've seen pictures and diagrams of that thing. They turned the mountain into a pillbox.
They turned every little structure they had into a pillbox. Every little structure. And there was, back when you got on the big end of the island, there was a lot of those, not like that hill,
right,
but like half as big and two-thirds as big. And they all had caves in them. They all had, oh, God, they had everything, every place. That guy that ran that island, that Japanese commander set that island up, he was a genius.
Kiribati.
Yeah, he must have been the best officer they had in the whole Japanese army, because they did never do anything foolish. They never ever showed themselves. So he had them extremely well trained, I guess. I don't know, but it was kind of like fighting ghosts, you know. You knew where they were, and you knew damn well they was out there because they was killing you. But you damn sure couldn't see too many of them.
Cal Humphrey, my guest here on that Thursday edition of All Marine Radio. We're talking about the Battle of Iwo Jima. And, Cal, the other thing about Hill 362, which is what you're talking about, is not only was it the hill itself that was, you know, fortified, but all the terrain that surrounded it, you know, that ringed it, was shooting as you tried to close with the hill, You know, Marines were getting shot in the back, were getting shot in the side from, you know, from the cliffs off to your right as you were moving to the north. And then from, you know, on the northern side, on the far side of Hill 362, the terrain, that there's a hill that goes up kind of behind it. You know, that dominated the approaches to it. So it was, you read about just getting to it, to get to it. You had the fight to do that. And it just, you know, the tactical problem that he put in front of you guys, as you said, he's a smart guy and absolutely brutal in terms of what it cost you guys in terms of casualties.
Yeah. Well, when we got over to that edge of that island, you know, like I told you, we didn't go down in that big swale.
Right.
It was quite a swale there. We went right around that, and when we come to this hill 362, see, we stayed on this side of it and went on around that curve, and that little depression was behind us.
Right.
And we were getting some shots from the rear, and I looked down there. They had a trench all the way up, a kind of a berm all the way across that thing, and it had gaps in it. And they had holes shooting at us from back down there and from on top. And we could walk probably had 12, 15 feet we could walk if we stayed up close to that bank. But if you got 2 foot out of that, you got shot. I had a good friend with me, his name was Red Cole, and I said, now Red, don't get up there. Stay down here. Damn if he didn't walk up there, and damn if he didn't get shot. Right through the side, went in one side and out the other, and I grabbed him and pulled him back down by me, and he said, I can't feel my feet. I said, you'd probably be all right, Red. You just hurt. But we had to leave him. They you just stick a rifle up. If they're alive, you don't put a helmet on top of it. If they're dead, you stick the rifle in the ground and put a helmet on top of it. But the litter bearers, hell, they couldn't keep up. They took mostly the live guys, and the dead guys a lot of time left and laid around for a day or two. But we finally took that. But that devastated, pretty well devastated our company. I don't know. They trained us, you know, to walk in single file and leave distance between us. And you know how guys are.
Right,
Christ,
right.
If there's a little jump, they have to jump over pretty soon. They're all bunched up in front of it. We did lose one complete full platoon just right off the bat there. And from then on out, well, we kind of was a little bit more careful how we did things, you know, but. Or, I mean, one complete squad.
My guest this morning, Cal Humphrey. He PFC when you went ashore. And when did you become a squad leader?
I became a squad leader about the last week, and only because I was one of the. There was three of us left: a guy by the name of Groneman, and me, and a corporal. And we were up in those hills, and we were walking down through we had about a 20-foot canyon we had to go through, and the bottom of it was all eroded out, and they came to a little wall in front of it. It was about a 5.5-foot wall. Well, you know how you do when you, we had all new guys, but three of us, damn, they didn't all crowd up in there. You know, right behind that wall, and I was bringing up the rear, and there was a cave on one side of it, and pretty soon grenades started coming over that wall, and guys started shooting out of that cave, and Jesus Christ, it was a mess, and I did finally get up there and kill a couple guys in the cave, threw a grenade in there, and threw a couple over the bench, but it was, you just didn't have anybody that Groman got killed right off the bat, and that was, we got a lot of medals over there in that island because the officers were so close, they could see damn near all the combats, you know, they could see all these firefights.
Right.
And I got a Silver Star for that, that little episode, which wasn't anything but a bunch of bullshit, because that kind of stuff happened every day.
it sounds like it did. Well, I got another email for you, Cal. Mac, as Cal looks at the battle, what was the most difficult part of the battle in his opinion?
Well, the worst part was, you know, when you had an objective, you just had to move out and you had to take whatever you had to take, you know. And like you say, if they had a cave, they had it protected by a couple of pillboxes, you know, out to each side, and maybe some spider holes, and maybe another little bunker or two. But they were all pretty well tied in, so you just, if you attacked one, you got shot by the others. And that was really hard and really tough. But that didn't bother me near as bad as laying in a foxhole getting mortared or a shell hole. That's what damn near run me out of my mind. In fact, I told Les one time, I said, Les, I'd just soon stay up here. I'd just soon not go back.
Oh, yeah, as they rotated your platoon and company?
Well, you had to go. Yeah, they rotated the company generally because you'd get up there and you might lose a platoon,
right,
half, and then you'd have to move another platoon up and lose some of them. Then you got to go back and get reinforcements. You can't get reinforcements up there, you know. Right. Damn, you got to go back.
Right.
It wasn't on account of ammunition or anything like that. We always had plenty of ammunition.
Just getting
short of water once in a while, but other than that, we had plenty of ammunition. And
all right, so the mortars are the things that used to piss you off.
That's what scared me, Landon. You knew damn well somebody was going to get, they're going to hit some of you.
Yeah. All right, another question for you. Mac, did Cal use the same rifle throughout the battle? Those guys must have pumped a lot of rounds through those rifles. Did he wind up getting a new rifle at any point because he wore his out? I've read stories about that. The same rifle the whole time, Cal?
Yeah, same rifle, and to be right truthful with you, we didn't really shoot that much. If we saw anything, or if we saw a hole, or if we saw this, or we saw that, we shot, or like if we were going up to, we had to take the flamethrower guys up. You know, three of us would go up before him and crawl up, and he would come up right behind us, and then we'd try to throw a few grenades and get a spot so he could get up there and put the flame in that hole of that cave or into the, and they shoot pretty far. Those flamethrowers are shooting 35, 40 feet, I think.
And that was forever on Iwo Jima, right? I mean, when most engagements are taking, you know, place less than 20 meters.
Oh, hell, they were terrible.
Yeah.
Terrible. Yeah, when you got in close and you got the, if once in a while those Japs would run out of those pillboxes and you'd see them, you know, they knew they were going to get burned after a while.
Right.
So they'd get it up, but they very seldom ever came out of the caves. And we could seal those caves pretty easy.
I got another email for you. Mac, did after hearing that he was wounded on D+19, that must have felt like an eternity in terms of time in close combat. Did he think he was going to get killed?
Everybody thought they were going to get killed, and that's what I told the recruits when they came up to me. Well, the ones I had after I took the squad over, I told them, look, guys, now, the odds of getting out of here alive are just almost nil. So anytime you see something move, or you see a hole in the ground, or you see a hole anywhere or anything, shoot at it. Now, I don't give a goddamn, shoot your whole clip up. We've got a lot of ammunition, but shoot at it. And keep your goddamn heads down. Don't be getting up, messing around, and looking around and not paying attention. Look in all directions, but look forward. I did not wear out my rifle. No, it was, I left the damn thing.
Where did you, tell us how you got wounded.
Well, we were, B Company had got wrecked that day, and our captain said, well, we're going to have to fill in that line. So my platoon had to go fill it in. And of course I was, Les said, you take your squad, Cal, left and go on down. You'll probably meet up with somebody down there on the end. Well, hell, we didn't meet up with anybody. I didn't see anybody for a quarter mile down there. So I told the guys, well, as far as we can go, so we'll just stay here. I'd seen where a tank had turned around, you know, and left a pretty good depression. And I said, we can dig in here a little bit and lay here in this tank track. And the next morning early, the tank came up. They must have called for it.
Okay.
And a guy popped out of the hood and he said, well, I'm looking for a target. And I said, well, you're the target, you dumb bastard. You're clear up here on the front line. I'll get on the phone and talk to you. So he got back in. I got up and walked around the back to grab that goddamn telephone. No more had it in my hand, and the mortar started falling. And it killed my two recruits. And I think I was, the one that got me was on the other side of the tank, because it just hit me in the upper body. And, of course, that tank, I didn't know this tank could burn rubber. If I'd been behind it, he'd have scorched me dead.
So you got hit. It hit
me pretty good, and I couldn't hear for about a month and a half out of that one ear, but it got me all on my left side, but none in my legs or anything, so the tank had to be protecting me a little bit. And I busted a vial of smelling salts and thought, well, it's got to be a goddamn aid station around here somewhere if they had that big a battle yesterday. And I staggered back there and found one back there.
So you walked back under your own power to the
well,
to
I
the...
walked and crawled and sat and rested and smelled my smelling salts.
How long do you think it took you to get to the aid station?
Oh, you know, I don't have any idea. I don't know. It, time just doesn't seem to make any difference to you when you're hurt. And I was hurt.
Well,
I had a couple of... Those Japanese must have had a lot of powder and not very much metal, because they put a lot of powder in their mortars, and they put a lot of powder in their grenades. And it busted them up into real small pieces.
Hmm.
And I had two pieces go in my chest. They left that in there.
Still got it? Still in there?
Yeah, it's still in there. And I had a piece, two pieces go through my helmet and stuck between my skin and my scalp. And a piece went through my arm, and then I had a pretty good piece hit me kind of on the chest there and dug a teacup full of meat out of there.
Teacup.
And I just, you know, and I think the concussion probably was what hurt my ear.
Yeah.
And that kind of makes you a little bit nutty, so you just don't know. I went the right way, probably.
In your case, nuttier, right?
Yeah, nuttier.
So, well, Cal, look, first of all, I've got one more question for you, and then we'll let you go. But can we do this again sometime? Can I give you a call when you come back on? Because there's a lot of lessons that we have to learn from you, and we kind of heard the story for the first time. So I'd love to talk to you some more. But I've got one more question for you, and then
okay.
All right. What makes a good Marine?
Well, I think a guy that can kind of keep his common sense. You know, the first thing they want to preach to you and get in your head that you're 10 foot tall and bulletproof, and you're not. So those guys that know what they can do and what they can't do and still keep their goddamn common sense instead of waving that flag all over hell makes a good Marine.
So don't lose your common sense.
No.
And to know that you can be just as dead as anybody else out here.
Absolutely, and everybody else in the service is just as good as you are. A lot of them came back from being on leave and the weekends and found out that those Army boys were just as tough as they were.
in spite of everything you saw in the movie?
In spite of all you see in the movie, absolutely.
Well, I'll tell you what, Cal, first of all, I can't tell you what an honor it is to have you on the program here. I've I've read about Iwo Jima and the battle I think as a lot of Marines have, most of my military career and stand in awe of guys like you who went over and fought that fight on a daily basis I can't tell you what it's been, what a thrill it's been for me to have you on. And I am gonna, I don't give a shit if you tell me, yeah, don't ever call me again. I don't care if you say that. I'll call you and bug you and drag you back on this program.
Yeah, this doesn't bother me much. I'll lay awake a night or two, but then I'll get over in a hurry.
Did you have very many mental problems when you came home? I mean, we call
it. I never had any, but I'll tell you what I did. I didn't go to any conventions.
Mm-hmm.
I didn't belong to the goddamn place where they all went up, got drunk with those. Everybody joined those.
The Legion and the VFW?
Legions, American
right.
Legion.
Right.
I joined and spent my money, and I still do, but I don't go in the joint. And I don't go. I don't go talking war talk to everybody. I just forgot it and left them alone. And I just had two buddies that I visited once in a while when I went to Phoenix. They both lived there. And that was the limit of what I did about it. Now, I don't think I didn't dream about it a hell of a lot, but I'd get up and read a book or something. I didn't lay there and suffer. So I got along great.
So you came and came home and tried to get as far as away from it as you could.
Just didn't want to be involved in any of that crap.
Interesting. All right, sir. Thank you very much today.
Okay. Well.
And we're going to do it again in the not too distant future. So.
All right, that'll be fine.
All right.
Okay. Bye bye.
All right. Bye bye. That is Cal Humphrey from Unbelievable. Right. Unbelievable story of life on Iwo Jima. And, you hear his perspective. They teach you that you're 10 feet tall, that you can be just as dead as everybody else. We're going to take a quick break. When we come back, we're going to continue a discussion we had yesterday we're headed for the Chosen Reservoir. Don Bennett's going to join us here in a minute. More of All Marine Radio. Coming up next, right here on the All Warrior Radio. Yeah, Iwo Jima to the Chosen. Come on, are you kidding me? This is a dream come true job. I keep saying that every day, but it is. More of that coming up next.
All I can say about MilitaryByOwner.com is, wow, I listed my house on your website for only 2 weeks in a tough rental market, and now my house is about to get rented. I will definitely recommend you guys to everyone in the military. Thank you.
Are you located near a military base? Advertise with Military by Owner for optimum exposure to the military community. Military by Owner has experience helping military families find, sell, or rent their home near a military base for the past 15 years. MilitaryByOwner.com, proven and dependable.